like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Kathy Stevens, founder and director of Catskill Animal Sanctuary, which, extending over 148 acres in New York's Hudson Valley, houses 11 species of farmed animals that have been rescued from cruelty, neglect, and abandonment. Typically, somewhere between 250 and 350 animals reside there at any given moment, and more than 4,000 have been rescued since Stevens started the sanctuary in 2001. Stevens is also the author of two books, Where the Blind Horse Sings, Love and Healing at an Animal Sanctuary, and Animal Camp, Lessons Learned from Rescued Farm Animals. We'll hear about the history and evolution of Catskill Animal Sanctuary, some of the animals living there, including, I hope, a pot-bellied pig named Sister Mary Frances, and more when I speak with Kathy Stevens in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later, I'll speak briefly with Jennifer Lockwood, a St. Petersburg pilot, who has coordinated and in some cases executed the rescue of hundreds of cats and dogs that were abandoned in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico in the wake of the hurricanes. Many of these animals have been adopted stateside, including in and around the Tampa Bay area. Lockwood sounds familiar. This interview was slated to happen about a month ago, but she was unavailable that day due to a rescue effort, and today represents the first opportunity to reschedule that interview. So let's get now to Kathy with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Kathy Stevens on Talking Animals. Good morning, Kathy.
Morning, Duncan. So happy to be with you and everybody. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us this morning on Talking Animals. So I'm guessing no one just looks out the window one day and says, you know, I think I'll start a sanctuary for farm animals. I mean, people do say that. And more than a few have said that over the years. But let's hear a bit about the prelude to your having said that. So what were you doing before you started Catskill Animal Sanctuary?
Well, interestingly, I had grown up on a farm, on a horse farm, but we always had and ate our own cows and a couple pigs, and I never questioned that despite my intense love of animals. And then I moved to Boston for grad school.
Where were you prior? Where was the horse farm?
That was, it was in Virginia.
Okay.
I'm a Southern girl.
Okay.
Reformed Southern girl.
All right.
And I moved to Boston for grad school in the late 80s and became a high school English teacher. And a decade into that work, was invited to become the principal of a new high school that was opening in Boston, a charter school that was opening in Boston. And it was a media and technology high school. And anybody who knows me has heard me say I was born in the wrong century. Right, I could live in a treehouse. So in media and technology, I use them, but they are not my friend. And so it was a mismatch. Had it been a school for the humanities or social justice, I would actually probably still be there. But it wasn't. And so I turned the job down, and then I was at this pivotal point where I thought, oh, my God, Kathy, this trajectory that you thought you were going to be on is no longer meaningful. I felt kind of done. And so I looked for a way to combine my deep love for and connection with animals with my love for teaching and learning. And so Catskill Animal Sanctuary is perhaps the preeminent teaching sanctuary in the country. So that's that. That's the short version.
Okay, well, I guess that's it for today. Thanks, and I guess we'll talk to you another time. That covers the whole story. Well, obviously, there's a few things that I would actually like to follow up on, including just going back at least briefly to the Virginia/horse farm formative years. So it was a horse farm. Obviously, there was cows and pigs there. Were those the kind of animals that you loved and connected with early on, or were there also cats and dogs and other animals that...
Oh, my gosh. Cats, dogs, a goat named Millie, a donkey named Linda. I've had animals in my life since I came out of the womb.
But it sounds like there was a little tilted, compared to many of us maybe, towards farm animals because you were living and growing up on a farm.
Well, except, you know, the quote-unquote food animals were sort of separate. It was a big property, and I certainly didn't have daily encounters with them in the same way that I did with the horses. My dad raised and trained thoroughbreds. There were a couple hundred horses. I was surrounded by horses, and to a lesser extent knew the cows and pigs. I would go visit them every now and then. They were not, you know, I didn't sort of pay. It was an effort to go see them, and I didn't have the same level of connection that I did with horses. But, boy, has that all changed.
Yeah.
Madly in love with pigs and cows.
Indeed, because there's a number of photos with you, obviously, if you've run a sanctuary over the years, and you've got appearances like this one and many others. There are photos of you at the sanctuary. So many of which radiate kind of a love and a profound connection, and not just you toward the animal that's in the photo, although that's clearly powerful, but in the other direction too. I mean, I've posted one or two on Facebook just to sort of help get the word out about this interview, and at least one person just commented like about just that very thing, like just there was just so much love in that photo. So when did you first feel like a really powerful connection with an animal, and which of the many animals we've already talked about was it that you maybe felt that especially strong connection with?
Do you mean since opening the sanctuary?
Well, no, at the very beginning, your very first powerful connection with an animal.
Way back when?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I think it was when I was 4 with a little dog named Frisky who followed me home one day, believe it or not. We lived way out in the country. This was before my dad bought this farm. We lived way out in the country on a dirt road. And my mother, this is like hard to believe now, but my mother would let my sister and I, when my sister was 2, stroll down the road. And one day, this little dog came bounding out of the woods, and her name was Frisky, and it was my first dog, and I still remember her.
Yeah, clearly. Well, that was a very different time in all kinds of ways, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, it was. Sure was.
So now, fast forwarding back to where we left off. So you say, hey, you know what? Principal, maybe, but not principal at a media and tech high school. So what am I going to do? Still, there's got to be a few critical steps because a lot of people have been at those kinds of career crossroads and haven't necessarily said, okay, I'm going to open an animal sanctuary. So talk me through some of those steps from saying, okay, not going to the high school, got to figure out what I am going to do, and then making the decision to go down the path that you did.
Well, what I recall, and I wrote about this in the very beginning of my first book, Where the Blind Horse Sings, is that I took... You know, I got my first job when I was 15, and I worked, you know, like most of us. You get to a certain age, and large part of your life is work. And so I took a few months off, which I had never done. Even as a teacher in the summer, I was always working. And did a lot of writing, and took a lot of long walks with my dog, and chatted with my closest friends, and I knew somehow that I wanted to work with animals, and I thought about vet school, but that did that. You know, nothing was the right fit. And then I stumbled upon, this was in the early days of the web, and I stumbled upon the concept of sanctuaries as very distinct from shelters. And as soon as I saw them, it it resonated very deeply. And then I also saw that there was a gap, that nobody was doing the educational piece, not really, not in any meaningful way. And so we, put one foot in front of the other, the way anybody does who's going down this path. And, 16 years later, here we are.
So once you stumbled across that concept and said, hey, this is speaking to me, a sanctuary for me is maybe more up my alley than a shelter, and the opportunity as someone who's been an educator to incorporate that element strongly, now we're talking. I think I may have found my niche here.
Yeah.
So when you did
cooking with vegan grease.
Okay. All right. We'll come back to that too. Once you said, okay, here's my light bulb moment, was there always sort of the twin objectives then of a sanctuary for animals? Because I do have this incredible longstanding love and connection with animals, but I also have this now fairly longstanding aptitude and passion for education. Were they always sort of intertwined, or did you, let me get
this. They've been intertwined. They've been intertwined from the get-go.
Yeah.
From the first time we wrote our mission statement before we took the first animal, and here's why. Somebody said, and is often quoted, if I don't know who said it, we cannot rescue our way out of this problem. Mm-hmm. There are sanctuaries opening every day, it seems, but you could open 1,000 more and not make a dent in the suffering. Every single life matters. And if I know anything about animals, is that the mantra that we use around here is, in the ways that truly matter, we're all the same. And what we mean by that is the desire to experience joy and avoid pain and suffering, our individuality. These things aren't species specific. We all are much more alike than we are different. And I choose to believe that most people are inherently good. And education for me, the classroom for me, I taught 11th and 12th grade English, and as much as I loved helping kids become better writers, better speakers, better thinkers, what I really got excited about was the idea that I could influence them, perhaps in a small way, to become better people, braver people, more compassionate people. And so that is the premise from which all teaching at Catskill Animal Sanctuary starts. Like, we believe that most people love animals. We know that nobody is intentionally saying, I'm going to have this steak so I can hurt an animal. No one is sitting down to a meal with the intention of harming. And so the challenge becomes, how do we appeal to the core values that all of us hold, the values of mercy and kindness and love and compassion, and help people understand what they are doing inadvertently when they make their everyday lifestyle choices about what to eat, what to wear, what products to buy. And we have all kinds of different programs to help us move that message forward. And honestly, Duncan, most importantly, we've got 300 or more animals that disarm people. Like, people don't expect to be licked on the face by a cow. People don't expect for a turkey to fall asleep in their lap. And when that happens, then we can just stop talking.
Yeah. The rest of the lesson takes care of itself probably at that point.
The lesson takes care of itself.
Yeah.
And then we've got to be there just to provide resources. And the in the form of a mentoring program or cooking classes or camps for kids or what have you.
So let me first just quickly say, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Kathy Stevens, founder and director of Catskill Animal Sanctuary, a 148-acre home to farmed animals that have been rescued from cruelty, neglect, and abandonment. If you'd like to ask Kathy a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Okay, so a couple things at least. One is, it sounds like the attitude is about how people just generally do view animals before they bite into that steak or whatever, is a huge generosity of spirit, like believing that there's the best in people and that just a few things have kind of gone awry from the fundamental premise of most people really do love animals.
Yes. I mean, you know, you could call that naive, but I would call it a choice that we make. I mean, I was listening recently to your interview with Paul Watson, Sea Shepherd. He has an entirely different approach because he has to, right?
Yeah.
You're not gonna convince people not to kill whales by having a conversation with them. He's going after the bottom line economically, which I thought he talked about very persuasively. This is the largest social change movement in history. We're asking every single person alive to change first his attitude and then his behavior, his or her, toward all other species. And so I believe that, A, like any other social movement, it takes a multi-pronged approach, not one size fits all. You know, if you want to protest, go have at it. If you want to lobby, have at it. What we can do most effectively is to lead with love and to show people how they, first of all, the suffering they are creating, not only for the animals, but also for the planet, and also for themselves by eating that toxic food. But then also by sort of empowering them to make changes in their journey toward veganism.
Yeah, well, I guess in some ways that's, I guess, partly what I meant by this sort of generosity of spirit, is that there are any number of ways to communicate that basic idea. And some people are lean a little bit maybe more towards the harsh or shrill thing, like just because they feel, drawing a parallel to what you're saying about Captain Watson, hey, I've got a big message and it's an urgent message, and so I've got to get it out urgently, which is just one school of thought and has its own effectiveness or lack thereof depending on who's on the receiving end. But I guess what I was really noting is that it sounds like that's you guys are going for a much different tone and approach. And also, as you all have already noted, if you're having that kind of conversation or try to impart that kind of lesson on the grounds of the Catskill Animal Sanctuary, you have 300 or thereabouts great Exhibit A's to help underscore that message.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And we also have, what happens is that people go on our tours and they come back and their hearts are wide open. They're crying. They're so moved. You know, not the vegans. The vegans already get it. They're coming here to, fill up their souls, go back out there again and keep doing their work. The non-vegans come back and, you know, a guy, I always tell the story of this guy who I met in the parking lot. He just finished a tour, and he walked up to me, and tears were streaming down his face, and he said, "I get it now. Tell me what to do." Right, so that's the state people are in when they finish a tour. And so right there on site, we then have cooking demos and food samples and recipes for people to take home and starter kits. And a mentoring program for people who might be, you know, want to tip their toe in the water but not know how to begin, or people who are struggling. So that, I think, is where we need to go as sanctuaries. I would urge sanctuaries. In fact, I do, when we have a lot of sanctuaries come to us for I don't want to say advice, guidance, or mm-hmm. what have you.
Sure.
Newer sanctuaries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've got to do as a movement, a sanctuary movement, a much better job at realizing the power that we've got when people come down our driveways and those animals open their hearts. And then to leverage that, because people, because otherwise, if people just go on a tour and then leave, you haven't empowered them to make change, right? So
you haven't given them enough.
We have. You haven't given them enough.
Yeah, and I'm glad. I know it sounded like you felt a little bit awkward that you're talking about sanctuaries, newer sanctuaries coming to you. But I mean, I think that's great because having done the show for a number of years, I've talked to all kinds of people from all kinds of sanctuaries. And a lot of the time, I mean, of course, they're all generally at least totally well-meaning and earnest. But a lot of the times you can see that they, part of the reason they got into it maybe is there was an urgent need and they stepped up, but that they've always kind of been scrambling. So that being able to do some of the things that you're talking about maybe eventually will come to them, but they, it seems like they're always kind of in crisis mode. So the kind of ideas and the kind of supplementing them with other things like a cooking demo or tasting food or something like that, I mean, that wouldn't even come up probably on their radar just because it's like, hey, we have a problem we have to solve immediately, and I don't know when we'll be done with that.
Well, I mean, you know, there's not, you can't take away anything from emergency rescue. Emergency rescue is emergency rescue.
Yeah.
And it's tough and it's unpredictable. You never know what the next email is going to bring. We got 3 emails about three different pig emergencies. There's an incredible unpredictability that comes with the territory. But having said that, I still land with the idea that sanctuaries have got to do far, far, far more. Because Duncan, simply because we might have saved over 4,000 animals through direct rescue, but multiply how many animals you save every time you create a vegan. You encourage a vegan by the thousands of vegans that we have created, and then you're talking about hundreds of thousands of animals or millions of animals. So that's, you know, we've got to eliminate the demand for animals, and sanctuaries that are stuck in emergency rescue mode, I believe, you know, I'm not judging it at all, but I just think could be far more impactful if they sort of looked beyond the emergency rescue. I mean, I'll be honest, you've got to have discipline, got to be able to say no. We said no to all 3 of those pig emergencies, and that felt bad. But we've got 22 pigs and 4 different friendship groups, and we don't have room. We're not going to build a tiny little pen in some corner just to accommodate. You know, so there's that.
Yeah, well, so let me follow up on that just because that was a question I was sort of curious about anyway, and now we're sort of there in a way. Because I got to believe there's an endless string of calls or emails like the ones you just mentioned.
Every day.
Yeah, so, and obviously you can't say yes to
every single sanctuary.
Yeah, so what is your criteria for deciding when you can say yes?
You do, so here's a philosophy that guides every decision. You try to do the greatest good for the greatest number. And that number includes who your current population is. Like our first and primary job is to have an environment in which all our current animals can thrive and become who they're meant to be and become some of them these larger than life, life altering teachers that I write about in my books. Like, you know, stories that would just blow people's mind. But right, so you know, we could theoretically, in fact we do, we theoretically have room for more horses. We've got 2 horses in a big old pasture, but they are needy, they are high strung, they came from not only a hoarding situation but a violent hoarding situation, and it wouldn't be fair to them to introduce more horses. So you gotta consider your current residents and their well-being, A, and then you've got to say, how can we do the greatest good for the greatest number? And then just look at your resources. What are your human resources? Do you have enough staff and volunteers to care well for a new influx? Do you have enough financial resources? You better not be taking January's money to pay for December's rescue, right?
Yeah.
So you're always just evaluating, trying to do the greatest good for the greatest number. And, you know, sometimes that means, well, I guess we're taking 400 chickens next week, you know, which we did once. And sometimes it means, you know, for a period of weeks, saying we can't take a tick. We can't take a flea.
Yeah.
Like we have no room.
Right.
So that's kind of.
Yeah.
But that's
also, I guess, what I kind of meant that with some other folks I've spoken to over the years. I didn't necessarily even mean to suggest that those people were in emergency rescue situations. I mean, sometimes they were, and of course that really shaded a lot of things. But a lot of the time, I just don't know if they had kind of the structure or the philosophy in place to make the kind of decisions with the kind of rationale behind them that you've just described, so that even if they're not in an emergency situation, it often, at least from the outside, looked like they were, and they described things that sort of sounded like they were, just because there were other factors, whether it was leadership or other things, that were compromising, I think, just the overall day-to-day operation. But so I mean, you couldn't take those three pigs, because the 22 pigs that are living there would have been impacted in a negative way. And by the way, before I forget, just because I've been so enchanted by her, can you just give me a quick lowdown on Sister Mary Frances?
Oh, piece of work. Sister Mary Frances is a little pot-bellied pig who any of your listeners has been here, she is one of our underfooters. And as I describe in my book, the underfooters are the lucky ones who get to free range all day long for a variety of reasons. And she is currently our only underfoot pig. And her tail, she goes out first thing in the morning, and she makes her own decisions about how she wants to spend her day. She has a routine, and she spends the entire day wagging her tail, knows her name, profoundly affectionate. You know, sometimes she's under a blanket in her stall, but usually on nice days she's in the horse field, in the cow field, in the goat field, you know, making the rounds, just greeting people and animals and seeing what mischief she can get into.
Yeah, well, she's certainly, at least by the photos, super cute. And again, I was taken with her name, just because you just don't find too many animals, pot-bellied pigs or otherwise, named Sister anything. So, I like that. So, again, this is Talking Animals with Duncan Strauss. My guest is Kathy Stevens, founder and director of Catskill Animal Sanctuary, which provides refuge to more than 250 rescued farm animals, including horses, cows, pigs, and goats. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, Kathy, let me raise one of the questions that came in from one of our emailers. It says, I love your guest. She's amazing. How does she deal with people that quote the Bible saying animals are here for us to eat? Thank you.
You know, man, there are so many different, I am not a biblical scholar, but I do know that there is the Christian Vegetarian Society, and there are a lot, you know, there's a publication out there called What Would Jesus Do? And there are books out there, most notably Dominion, that's been out for a number of years, such a powerful book, that asks the question, what did God mean when he granted humans dominion over animals? Did he intend, if God is a he, God's probably not a gender, did he intend for dominion to mean control? Like we get to call all the shots. They are here for us to do with as we please. Or did dominion mean caretaking. And, what I do know is that I am not a conventionally religious person. I would call myself spiritual, not religious, but I do, believe that if there is something like a God, that God loves all of us, and that God could not justify, if it is unnecessary for us, and it is, could not justify one species acting as if we are the only ones who matter. And that's what we do. We act as if we are the only ones who matter, and then those actions have enormous consequences for every single other living being, including the planet. I don't think God is too happy, if God is out there, that we are destroying this planet in large part by the consequences of growing billions and billions and billions of animals to feed a rapidly growing human population. There's a beautiful little activity that anybody can Google. It's called Earth as an Apple. Earth is an apple, and the beauty of it is that a six-year-old can understand it. And essentially, you use the apple to represent the earth and carve it up to show that only 3% of the earth is available to grow the food that we need to feed every human being and every single animal. And we are, you know, with our population expected to be 10 billion by the mid-century, and the requirement, you know, the fact that eating animals requires 15 to 20 times the amount of natural resources, whether that is soil or water or energy, right? We cannot sustain this. There will not be a livable planet for future generations. And so there is an urgency. I'm sort of going off track, and I apologize to you and the listener, but, you know, those are some of my random thoughts about what God would say and how to approach people like that.
Well, along those lines, part of your answer was that you're not so much religious but spiritual. So in the context of that, and we've, of course, established from the get-go pretty much that you loved animals from the time you were a little kid and had a profound connection then and certainly do now. So what does it do to your spirit? I mean, we haven't really gotten into the specifics, but we've kind of noted that the animals that come to Catskill Animal Sanctuary have experienced some kind of cruelty, neglect, or just simply been abandoned. So over now 16 or so years of taking in those animals and what brings those animals to you, or at least to your attention, I mean, how does that affect your spirit and your soul?
Duncan, I have to say, I love your interviews, and now that I'm experiencing one, I'm articulating what I love. What I love is how well you listen, and you're great at listening well and letting the conversation lead itself. So thank you for that.
Flattery will get you everywhere, Kathy. No, but so
excuse my cold.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. You know, if I'd known you were feeling this crummy, we would have tried to reschedule or something.
Oh, it's fine.
Okay.
I've always been joyful. Life to me is really pretty damn simple. We are here to give and receive love. That's about it. Not a whole lot else matters. When we take in these broken beings, whether they're broken physically or broken psychologically or both, we go into overdrive. There's no time, there's no room for us, I think that's typical of our sanctuary. There's no room for sadness or anger, because you're just consumed by caring for them, and by what drives us is not only their physical needs to make them physically healthy, but ultimately, even more importantly, to help them learn to trust again. And that, to be honest, to participate in that has been the greatest privilege of my life. And I just, for whatever reason, I think all of us, the sadness and the anger is not what we feel. It's just sort of quiet determination to do all that we can to help these breathtaking animals who want the same things we want. So I don't really know how to explain it, except that I don't feel, when you take in a horse who's 400 pounds underweight, right, or who can't even, we took in a horse once who was so chronically starved for so long and so weak from being chronically starved, he probably had a few days left to live. He couldn't even whinny. Like, all that came out of his mouth was breath. And he couldn't stand up for more than a few minutes of time. So, when the cases are extreme like that, you know, everybody who saw him burst into tears. But it doesn't last. What lasts is the joy that comes and the sense of purpose that comes from helping them get to the other side and know that life can be good.
Yeah, it sounds like when a horse like that arrives, everybody's heartbroken, but it sounds like also over time, when that horse starts to heal in all kinds of ways, that as that horse is healing, that whatever heartbreak might have been caused by seeing that horse and knowing what that horse had been through, you know, each person's heart probably does a bit of healing along the way, too.
Quickly.
Yeah.
Because one thing we've learned, like we've... You know, when I have more time and can write my third book, I'm gonna think even more than I do now about the lessons we've learned from animals. But they are, some are more resilient than others, but generally, I just as with humans, but they are pretty resilient, and they pretty darn quickly, some of them, from the moment they step off the trailer, understand that they're in a very different place. So the healing begins immediately. Yeah.
No, that's great. And we're sort of nearing the end of our time, unfortunately. So one of the things I want to kind of circle back to was the strong educational element to Catskill Animal Sanctuary. So when you're talking about those tours, are they predominantly school kids of various ages, adults? Is it mixed? I mean, how do you...
We have three kinds of tours. We're open to the public on weekends. In season, we can't be open in the winter. It's just too much, too harsh, too hard to be open in the winter up here. But we have weekends that are open to the public, and we have a tour scheduled every 30 minutes. We have member tours. If you're a sanctuary member or a guest at our bed and breakfast, you have the privilege of being able to do tours year-round. Those have to be scheduled. And then we do all year long, not too much in the winter again. School groups, tours that are customized based on the age, the curricular needs, the interests of the teacher or the school. And we do, you know, sometimes it's just a classroom, but sometimes it's 100 kids or more. And we've got a whole program lined up for them, and that's what we do. And then, of course, we have Camp Kindness in the summer. For kids, and we're going to be piloting another program, a youth leadership program, this summer as well. Well,
that sounds great, and it sounds like probably has a profound impact, no matter who it is, whether it's an adult or a school kid. But I would think that if you can get folks in younger, so much the better for trying to kind of help shape their perception.
Create lasting change.
Yeah,
yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to move the needle.
Yeah. And speaking of change, over these 16 or thereabouts years since you launched Catskill Animal Sanctuary, how would you say you've changed most in that period?
Wow. What, I've never been asked that question.
All right. Well, there I am with my crazy, pesky questions. But
No, that's beautiful. I hope people would say I have become more patient. I certainly now understand unquestionably that the differences between a chicken and myself or a pig and myself are far outweighed by the similarities. I did not know that chickens are affectionate. I did not know how much chickens love and will defend to the death their children. I didn't know that 10 chickens are as individual as 10 people, right? But they are. And so though, like, knowing all of that has been a game changer for me and a game changer in terms of what kinds of programming we offer it and how we deliver it.
That's really interesting. That's, I guess, part of the reason I wanted to ask that. I mean, I didn't obviously have any idea what the answer would be. But it sounds like, because we established early on that big animal person and had a real strong kind of emotional other kind of connection with them. But the fact that even with coming in that way and sort of unusually connected to and passionate about animals, that there would be that sort of much more of a deeper understanding that you would arrive at, I think is notable by itself. And like you say, then helps further influence and shape what goes on at the sanctuary and probably the books or the next book, at least, that you'll be writing, just because they'll reflect just how much more you understand about animals and how they pertain to some of those other species.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool.
And I think one other way that I haven't changed, and this is, maybe I'll sign off with this because this is for anybody who is contemplating starting a sanctuary, I would say this work ain't for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
Right? And a lot of people just come to us with, you know, just this romanticized version of it. And I still, 16 years into it, I still work probably 70 to 80 hours a week, first thing in the morning until I fall down at night. You know, it's, and I strive. I have a wonderful partner. I have two beautiful dogs. I have incredible friends and family. I still struggle for some balance. So I would say to anybody who's listening who thinks they want to do this, you better ask yourself if you really are prepared to work that hard, because I don't know a sanctuary founder who doesn't have a similar story.
And also, no sick days, clearly. So if you're sick, hey, no, the beat goes on. Yeah.
What is that? Yeah.
Yeah. No. So I'm just going to end this because we are sort of even actually a bit over our time. But one of our emailers, I want to just read this, and that'll be kind of our last word, I think, here is this emailer says, I'm loving this interview. I wish I lived closer to her because I would like to be her BFF. I wish there were more people like her in this world. So I think that's the perfect point at which we've been speaking with Kathy Stevens, founder and director of Catskill Animal Sanctuary. The website is casanctuary.org, and of course they're also on Facebook, etc. So Kathy, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
It has been an honor. Thank you for sharing that lovely comment, and keep on keeping on.
All right, thanks
again.
Thank
you very much, Duncan.
Bye-bye. In a few moments, I'll speak with Jennifer Lockwood about the efforts to help cats and dogs abandoned U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico after the hurricanes by bringing them stateside and adopting them out. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner, which we'll be hearing a piece from Nate Bargatze. This is, in fact, Nate Bargatze with How to Get Bitten by a Snake in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I went to Honduras, another place. Because I was at the airport, and the guy was like, I was like, I'm going to Honduras. He was like, what city? And I was like, I'm just learning right now that's not the name of the city. So... just wherever other people are going, probably. Let's just go there and figure it out. We get to the base, and the guy, he's like telling us about Honduras, and he's like, you gotta be careful. He's like, you gotta really look out for snakes. There's a lot of venomous snakes here. So when you walk around, just keep an eye out. And he was like, now if you get bit by a snake, the best thing to do is then just go ahead and catch the snake and bring it so then we know, like, what snake bit you. I was like, dude, I'm pretty positive that's, like, exactly what you're not supposed to. Like, I've never seen that ever on Animal Planet. Like, someone gets bit and then they got to be like, now I got to get it. I was like, I'm not going to do it. I was like, that doesn't make sense. I've never caught a snake in my life. And then when I got bit for the first time, I got to get it together and catch a snake. I was like, it's not going to go good, man. I was like, he's going to keep biting me. That's all that's going to happen. And he was like, it doesn't matter. Like, you've already been bit. And I was like, do you even know what a snake is? It completely matters. There's a huge difference between one bite and probably 30 bites. That's what we're going to be at if I try to catch this snake. Who told you this? The snake? Is that who told you to tell me all of this? Whose side are you on?
That was Nate Bargatze with a piece called How to Get Bitten by a Snake, taken from his appearance on Stand Up Planet. Now on to my conversation with Jennifer Lockwood about efforts to adopt out animals in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico that were made homeless by the hurricanes. This is Jennifer Lockwood on Talking Animals. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So how did you first get involved with the effort to rescue the animals left abandoned in those areas in the wake of those hurricanes?
Well, I used to live in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands for about 5 years. I moved to St. Pete a couple years ago, but I still work down there and regularly visit. So when the hurricanes hit, a few people that I know got together, started making a lot of phone calls, and were able to send the plane down there. I work at St. Pete Air,
okay.
Albert Wooded Airport in St. Pete. So
yeah.
We got a connection right away with some flights going down, and then the need came up for so many of the animals that were displaced because the animal shelters on the islands were devastated.
Right. So when they were devastated, was the idea like just to swoop in and say, hey, for now at least, let's get as many of these animals off of here, hopefully find homes, at least temporarily or otherwise, and then when things calm down and we're a little bit more on solid ground, we can kind of sort out who goes where?
Yeah, it was like an immediate action.
Yeah.
So the planning, it just kind of all came together. I was contacted by people from the animal shelter and a group called Island Dog Rescue. They were coordinating most of the animals to get off the island. So we worked with them to fill the plane up. And it was crazy. So many people showed up to the flight, like more than we could fit. So we just maxed out with as many pets that had either owners in the States that needed to be reunited, or shelter animals that needed to be rehomed.
And so if I understand this, some of this was down St. Croix and areas you were familiar with, but did it also extend to Puerto Rico as well?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so what seems like, as we know, unfortunately, that's been, you know, not very well handled in all kinds of ways. Even today in the New York Times, there was a story about the hospital boat, the Comfort. It just was not really fully utilized, and there was all these snags and whatever. So even now, is the animal situation at least kind of stabilized in Puerto Rico?
No, I don't think so.
No. Okay.
A group that we're working with called Compassion Kind, they're based out of St. Pete, but they do a lot of work in Puerto Rico. She has a shelter in Las Piedras, which was one of the most devastated towns where the eye went through.
Yeah.
And they have about 70 pets there right now that get off the island. There's just a surplus of stray animals that they need medical attention. And everybody is so taxed, you know, for lots of different reasons.
For sure.
I kind of think that animals kind of fall behind.
Yeah. So
a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah. So Jennifer, just so we make sure we get this in before we might run out of time here, are there one or more websites that people listening could go to find out how they could help, either if they're inclined to adopt an animal or if they're inclined to just support the efforts in this regard?
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to stay up to date on our efforts, the website is usvirelief.org.
Okay.
And a group we partnered with, Compassion Kind, her Facebook page has the photos and details of the animals that are now in St. Pete that still need to be adopted.
Okay,
so you
cool.
can go to her Facebook page, Compassion Kind.
Okay, so we just search for Compassion Kind on Facebook, and otherwise mm-hmm. usvirelief.org. Okay, cool. Well, I'm sorry we're sort of short on time, but I'm glad we got a bit of an update, and we can send people to those websites or the Facebook page to find out more or to help or maybe even adopt an animal here. So thank you so much, Jennifer. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Right. Thanks for your help.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, this is Talking Animals. Rob Lori is up next. This is Talking Animals Indeed on WMNF Tampa, Brandon Largo, Wiggy Wachee, and Beyond. NPR News Headlines is next. Thanks.